The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So my name is Andrea Fella, for those of you who don't know me. And tonight we are continuing with discussion on the 10 qualities of the paramis, which are qualities that we cultivate as we walk on this path of awakening. Tonight we're talking about truthfulness and resolve, two qualities we'll talk about together tonight. So truthfulness, just as a definition of truthfulness in the suttas, I found a definition that said, that is true which has an undeceptive nature. So truth is that which is undeceptive. So in terms of our practicing this, we practice this non-deception in terms of our speech and our action. That's kind of the base level of practicing truthfulness, is to not be deceptive in our speech and actions. And that part is also covered in the parami of virtue that we talked about, that Jim Podowski talked about several weeks ago. So the quality of truthfulness in speech is part of ethical conduct. So that part of truthfulness, in my way of understanding these paramis, is only a small part of what it means by truth. So I look at the larger part of truthfulness as being the not deceiving ourselves, the truthfulness to ourselves. This brings in the quality of non-delusion. And we'll talk more about that in a few moments. So not deceiving ourselves. And then there's a not being deceived about the true nature of our experience. We are often deceived into thinking that our experience is permanent and that it is satisfactory. And we'll talk also more about this in a little while as well. So non-deception, a characteristic of truthfulness. So truthfulness, in terms of this list of these 10 qualities, and for those of you who haven't heard this list, I'll just mention that the 10 qualities that we're talking about these 10 weeks, they are generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, kindness, and equanimity. And the order of the paramis, the order of these qualities, there's usually some link between them. So the quality of patience precedes truthfulness, and then resolve follows truthfulness. So how are these linked together? Last week I talked about patience having three aspects: the aspect of persistence, the aspect of tolerance of injustice, and the aspect of acceptance of truth. And this is where I feel that patience leads into truth, because it is the acceptance of things as they are that is the culmination of patience. So essentially, patience becomes perfected when the truth of our experience is understood. So when we understand the true nature of our experience, patience is manifest. Patience manifests. And resolve following truthfulness, because to really begin to understand things as they are we have to first take essentially on faith some of these teachings, some of the teachings of the Dharma. We often can't just understand them right away. So we have to resolve to apply ourselves to understand them. So the truth is perfected through the determination to practice. Truthfulness, the understanding of the truth, the non-deceptiveness of the non-deception of ourselves, and the fact that we are not deceived about the nature of our experience. This requires resolve to actually enter into our experience. So resolve, the definition of resolve, is really, in this context, a determination towards this practice, towards this bringing our attention back to what is happening in the moment, moment by moment, just bringing the attention back. So the determination to continue to wake up for what is actually happening in the moment, as opposed to what our thoughts about what's happening are. So as I just mentioned, resolve follows from truthfulness. And the quality that follows resolve is kindness, is loving kindness. And I think this points to the fact that this determination to practice is not only about becoming true to ourselves, but in that process, it also opens our heart to other beings. So it opens our heart to kindness as we become non-deceived by ourselves and not deceived by the nature of our experience. It opens our heart to kindness. So this points toward the determination to not only practice for oneself, but to practice for others as well. And this actually happens kind of naturally. As we practice for ourselves, our hearts open. There's a kind of an interweaving I see between these two qualities, because the quality of truth we first have to have a little bit of understanding of what we are trying to do. There's a little bit of a confidence in the teachings. We have to start from some confidence in the truth of the teachings. So we start from this where we don't actually know the truth ourselves, but we are willing at least to engage. We're willing to experiment and explore with this practice of bringing our attention back to what is actually happening. So we have a little bit of confidence or some faith in the teachings. So we believe perhaps in the possibility that the teachings will help us to suffer less in our lives. We believe in the benefit of the teachings, or we have some faith in the benefit of the teachings. We have some confidence in the truth of the teachings. And we have some confidence in our capacity to practice. So at first there's not a full understanding of the truth of what it means to not be deceived by ourselves and not be deceived by the nature of our experience. But we reflect on the teaching and we decide, okay, I'm going to try this. So the little bit of truth of this teaching that points to there is the possibility for an open heart that is not constricted around our experience, and that open heart will not suffer in experience. So that teaching or that pointing gives us a sense of energy to engage in the practice and the resolve to practice. So really these two come together. We have a little bit of sense of trust in the teachings, and then we resolve to practice a little bit, and that in turn gives us more confidence in the truth of the teachings. Because the teachings actually bear investigation with your experience. If you actually bring your attention to your experience in the present moment, you will start to see the truth. So I'd like to talk a little more about this non-deception of ourselves. So in the view of the Buddhist teachings, we all deceive ourselves a lot, essentially through having a filter or view through which we view our experience. We see the world in terms of certain ideas, certain concepts, and these concepts distort reality, distort the truth of our experience. So this non-deception towards ourselves is the beginning of a willingness to explore the ways in which we deceive ourselves, the ways in which we don't see the truth. That's the way through. We can't simply say, let these deceptions go away and have them go away. They're very deeply ingrained in all of us. They're not easy to see through. So there's four fundamental, the teachings tell us there's four fundamental ways that our perception is distorted. It's distorted by we take what is impermanent to be permanent. We take what is unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. We take what is not self to be self, and we take what is unbeautiful to be beautiful. So just to give an example of one of these, we take what is unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. This kind of thing happens to us all the time, all throughout our day. We think that what will make us happy, what will satisfy us, is to have something. We think if we get the things that we want and get rid of the things that we don't want, that we will be happy and will be satisfied. And that's true for a short time. If we arrange our world to be the way we'd like it to be, we can feel satisfied for maybe a minute or two. Or maybe a day or two. But it doesn't take long for those conditions to fall apart. And then we have to do something more to create the conditions so that we are satisfied with our world again. And essentially we're on this treadmill of having to continually get what we want, get rid of what we don't want. And that's what we think satisfaction is. So this is a fundamental misunderstanding of satisfaction. But we can't, it's hard for us to see any other way to be satisfied than to get what we want. If there's something that we want, to have it, or something that we don't want, to get rid of it. We just can't even imagine any other way to proceed in terms of happiness. The teachings of the Buddha tell us that the way to proceed is to observe that the wanting itself is impermanent. The wanting itself is the source of the dissatisfaction. So essentially, the dissatisfaction is the dissatisfaction. And the dissatisfaction is impermanent. It will disappear. So if we can simply turn our attention to that feeling of dissatisfaction, which is either the wanting to have something we don't have or wanting to get rid of something that we do have that we don't want, if we can turn our attention to that feeling itself and notice what happens as you pay attention, at some point that feeling of wanting will go away. And when that feeling of wanting goes away, it's like being released from a vice grip. So the other path to satisfaction is letting go of the wanting. It doesn't seem like an option. It seems so hardwired for us to want things that we like and to want to get rid of things that we don't want. So it's this truth of we take what is unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. It takes some exploration through this turning of attention to our experience, observing this feeling of the wanting, observing that feeling and noticing what happens as it ends. It's optional. We don't actually have to want things that we like. It's a challenge. I mean, this teaching is not easy. None of these are easy. And they're hard to believe, some of them. You know, the teaching that we take what is not self to be self. What does that mean, anyway? We take what is not self to be self. This one's particularly hard to understand, and I won't go into a whole teaching on the understanding of not self tonight. But I will say that these teachings aren't set out there as things to believe. That's one really key piece to the truths of this, of the Buddhist path. That they're not set out as truths to believe. They are put out there as an invitation to explore. Come and see in your own experience. I described the way to look at the question about taking what is unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. All of these will be shown to you. The truth of all of these will be shown to you if you simply bring wise attention to your experience. So we start with wise attention. The first instruction with wise attention is to understand suffering. Understand where you suffer. So this again is turning towards experience. When we feel suffering, rather than trying to fix it or change it, which is our typical movement, we don't like the feeling of suffering, we want to get rid of it. We think that will make us happy to get rid of that feeling of suffering. The movement here is pointing to understanding suffering is the way to freedom from suffering. Understanding suffering. So we resolve to understand suffering. This teaching on understanding suffering is the first noble truth. So we come back again to truth, the teaching of truth, the first noble truth. So through the exploration of exploring the ways that we suffer, being willing to turn our attention to what it's like to be a human being that's suffering, not the thoughts around it, but the experience of loneliness, the experience of sadness, the experience of frustration, not the thoughts about it, but the experience. And any reactivity we have to that experience. Loneliness. I don't like loneliness. There's aversion to the loneliness. All of these, if we know what's happening, if we turn our attention to what's happening, and we also then turn our attention to what our relationship is to what's happening. So it's two parts. There's the thing that's happening, the loneliness, a painful knee, there's a sound, there's all of these things that are happening. And then there's the way that we relate to them. Oh, I like that, I don't like that. Want to get rid of that, want to fix that, want to change that. We have to also recognize that that is something that's happening in the present moment. That's essentially the way to begin to pull back those veils of deception. Because those voices of I like that, I don't like that, those are the voices of deception. So can we begin to notice that those are simply other things happening in the present moment? What does it feel like to not like experience? What does that feel like to be lonely? And then, oh, I don't like that. What is that not liking like? So turning to experience, looking at our relationship, will successively, slowly over time, begin to reveal those layers of deception and clear them. Clear those layers of deception so that we are meeting our experience with more truth, more truthfulness. So that's enough about truthfulness, I think, for now. And I'll talk a little bit about resolve. I'm going to do this by telling two stories. I'm going to point at resolve by talking about two stories from the Buddha's lives. The first one is a myth, and the second we don't really know how much of these things are, you know, actually happened, but they point to two different ways that resolve functions. So there's truth in these stories in the sense of the story, whether they actually happened or not. So the myth of the ascetic Sumedha. This is the story of the Buddha in many, many lifetimes before he was born as Siddhartha Gautama. So eons and eons before he was born as Siddhartha Gautama and became enlightened and became what we know, the being that we know of as the Buddha, it is said that the ascetic Sumedha was living in the time of the previous Buddha, the Buddha Dipankara Buddha. And this ascetic Sumedha was essentially the same life continuum that eventually became Siddhartha Gautama. So, previous life of the Buddha. So, he was an ascetic living in the Himalayas. And one day he saw that people were kind of decorating the road and you know, there seemed to be some big festival that was being planned. And he asked people what was going on, and they said, the Buddha is coming. Dipankara Buddha is coming to the town. And so he went, this ascetic, the Buddha-to-be, our Buddha-to-be, went and helped to prepare a part of the road for Dipankara Buddha. And Dipankara Buddha was coming along the road, and the road where the ascetic Sumedha was preparing wasn't quite prepared. And there were ruts and mud in the road. And so the ascetic Sumedha lay down in the road so that the Buddha could walk over him and not get his feet muddy. And as he looked up at the face of the Buddha, he was so inspired by the Buddha that he resolved that someday he too would become a Buddha. And the Dipankara Buddha, seeing into his mind, saw that he had the capacity to become a Buddha and told him that his wish would be fulfilled eons and eons and eons in the future. So that life stream of the ascetic Sumedha was reborn over and over and over again in the lifetimes to come. And it is said that in those eons of being born, that he was born in many different forms. He was born as animals, as poor people, as ascetics, as rich kings. He was born in all different forms of life. And during those lifetimes, it is said that the main practices that he was doing was cultivating these 10 qualities of the paramis that we're talking about. Those were his practices, to cultivate generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, kindness, and equanimity. So I think this story points to the way a resolve can function over a long period of time. That we can make a resolve for something that we don't quite have the capacity for in this moment, but that it will shape our choices. So essentially, a resolve can serve in this way, that it points us to an aspiration. We connect to something that has meaning and truth for us, and we direct our lives in that way. So thinking about what are your deepest priorities, and are the choices you make moment to moment in line with those priorities? That's a way that resolve functions. That, you know, with this movement towards an aspiration, we don't simply make that aspiration and then forget about it. It informs our moment to moment choices. The second story is the night that the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and became enlightened. It is said that he'd been practicing for about 7 years, and he'd done all of the ascetic practices, the ones where, you know, you eat a grain of rice a day and you'd starve yourself and you sit through searing pain. And he'd done all of those practices, and those had not yielded the fruit that he was looking for. They had not yielded the happiness, the unconditional happiness that he was searching for. So he took some food, got his health back, and the night he sat under the Bodhi tree, he made a resolve. He said, "Though only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and my blood and flesh dry up and wither away, yet I will never stir from this seat until I have attained full enlightenment." That's a resolve in the moment. So it points to how we can also really, you know, stand firm and with our intention connect to what is most meaningful to us in this moment. I think these two stories together point to, though, lest any of you want to go home tonight and sit until you are fully enlightened. These two stories together point to the fact that there's a kind of a, we need a kind of a wisdom to know what we are capable of in a moment. So when the Buddha sat down under that Bodhi tree, he had a sense of what his capacity was that night. And his resolve was, if it is humanly possible, I will do this. Eons before, as the ascetic Sumedha, he had not made the resolve, may I become enlightened in this moment. He had made the resolve someday to become a Buddha and to cultivate the qualities over eons. So we need some wisdom to guide us here in our choices. There is a place for a firm resolve. And there's a place for understanding what we are capable of in a moment. The ideal would be to always come to the highest level we're capable of in any moment. And my guess is that few of us are able to do that. But we may be able to do it more often than we think we can. In our lives, living the lay lives that we do, engaged in work, engaged with family, with relationships, we often can't quite make the most ideal choice to match our aspirations. And so we sometimes have to look at what one writer calls the art of the practicable. What is suitable for this moment? So sometimes this means, at least for me, it has meant a kind of a reframing of what I'm doing, in a sense that, For example, I gave this example a few months ago, so some of you may have heard of this. For a few years, this year I have let go of my my other livelihood, and I am supporting myself just through the teaching. But in the years previous, I had work as a technical writer to support myself while I practiced and while I taught. And it didn't feel optimal in a way to work for 5 hours a day as a technical writer, talking about 3D graphics for programmers. You know, it took me away from the Dharma in the sense of that being kind of the being immersed in the world of thinking about the Dharma. For 5 hours a day, I had to think about the world of 3D graphics. And yet, I mean, I did practice while I was doing it, so I was bringing in the practice. And the way I worked this for myself, or I reframed it for myself so there wouldn't be feel like a conflict. This work supports my ability to teach. It supports my ability to go on retreat. So it is skillful. It's allowing me to head towards my deepest aspiration. So while it wasn't necessarily ideal, it was suitable. It was practicable. So looking at our choices, sometimes we have to look at them through this kind of reframing. Is this suitable, and is it headed in the direction of my aspiration? I'll tell a final story that ties both truthfulness and resolve together. This is Ajahn Lee's story of the Buddha as he was deciding what he wanted to do with his life. And I'll just read this. The Buddha saw that the ease and happiness of ordinary pleasures is nothing lasting. He wanted an ease and happiness that didn't follow the way of worldly pleasures that most people want. This was why he left his family and friends and went off to live in seclusion. He said to himself, "I come alone. I came alone when I was born, and I'll go alone when I die. No one hired me to be born, and no one will hire me to die, so I'm beholden to no one. There's no one I have to fear. In all my actions, if there's anything that's right from the standpoint of the world, but is wrong from the standpoint of truth, and wrong from the standpoint of my heart, there's no way I will be willing to do it." So he posed himself a question. Now that you've been born as a human being, what is the highest thing that you want in this world? He then placed the following conditions on his answer. In answering, you have to be really honest and truthful with yourself. And once you've answered, you have to hold to your answer as an unalterable law on which you have affixed your seal, without ever letting a second seal be affixed on top. So what do you want, and how do you want it? You have to give an honest answer, understand? I won't accept anything false. And once you've answered, you have to keep to your answer. Don't be a traitor to yourself. When he was sure of his answer, he said to himself, "I want only the highest and most certain happiness and ease, the happiness that won't change into anything else. Other than that, I don't want anything else in the world." Once he'd given this answer, he kept to it firmly. He didn't allow anything that would have caused the least bit of pain or distraction to his heart to get stuck there as a stain on it. He kept making persistent effort with all his might to discover the truth, until he finally awakened to that truth, the reality of liberation. So resolve and truth work together. So I'd like to take a few minutes to teach you a practice. This is a practice that I think is really useful with these qualities of the paramis. It's a reflective practice. It's a practice that allows you to ask yourself questions in a meditative way. Basically, so it's a way to think about something through the framework of the silence of meditation. So the basic practice is to settle yourself into stillness, and I'll talk about this for a little while and then we'll do it. To settle yourself into stillness, to prepare a question for yourself before you go into the meditation, a question you want to explore deeply, a question that you are interested in understanding. And it can be any kind of a question. Just one, it should be one that has some meaning for you. Perhaps of, what is my relationship to ethics, or something that's meaningful for you. It could be something about a major life decision that you need to make. So this will bring some meditative reflection into the answering of that question. So prepare your question before you go into the meditation, so you don't have to spend time thinking about it once you're in there. Then settle yourself in meditation for some time, say 5 minutes or so. And then in the silence and stillness of that meditation, drop your question. Don't think about it. Don't try to answer the question. Just see how that question impacts your experience. It's kind of like dropping a pebble into a still pond and watching the ripples. You drop a question into the stillness of your meditation, and there will be some ripples. There may be feelings that emerge. There may be images or thoughts. The practice is to just notice what has emerged, but don't follow those, don't think about those things. Just kind of take note of that. Then go back to the question. Just go back to the question. When I recommend people doing this practice, I usually suggest that they do it with a particular question over a period of a week or two. And after each time you do this practice, take a few notes about what you noticed. You don't have to have an answer the first time. Essentially, you're just kind of opening yourself up to a kind of more intuitive place that does get opened as we bring the silence of meditation in. That just dropping a question into that silence of meditation, it can go deeper. And sometimes the things that bubble up may have a quality that you're not really sure of. You know, what does that have to do with anything? Just make a note of it. Keep a little journal and make a note of what you've noticed over the course of a few weeks. After a couple of weeks, then start reflecting on what you have learned. So I'll just give a little bit example. When I tried this at one point, I wanted to understand for myself what the benefits of behaving ethically were. And I asked myself that question, what are the benefits of ethical behavior? What are the benefits of sila, the Pali term for ethics? The first day I did this, I asked that question, and the feeling that came, that bubbled up, was loneliness. And I didn't really understand what that meant. But, you know, I made a note of it. And over the course of a couple of weeks, I began to understand and see that that relationship is a big part of ethical conduct, that it's creating a skillful relationship between us, between self and other. And then I began to understand that the loneliness is what happens when we're disconnected. When we don't behave ethically, we're disconnected, and loneliness comes up. So that was then after a few weeks, I began to understand more of the things that had bubbled up. But it wasn't something I thought about at the time. So really encourage you, if you do this practice or try this practice, to just see what bubbles up and then make some notes about it. And then look back over it later and see what you can understand about the things that have bubbled up. It's almost like looking at little bits of dreams, you know, little information that comes almost from dreams. It's a little snippet here, this little snippet there, this little snippet, and then you can kind of begin to pull it together using your understanding. So let's try this, and I will give you the question today, so you don't have to think about one. Actually, I'll actually drop some other words before I drop the question in. I'm just going to drop some words in to the meditation as well. And just again, notice what the impact is of those words on your experience. No need to do anything with them. Just notice what the impact is and just go back to your experience. It's just a staying with your experience. So allowing yourself to relax and settle into a alert posture. Connecting to as much relaxation as you have access to right now. Taking a couple of deep breaths. And letting your breathing return to normal. And allowing your attention to settle on the experience of breathing. With each half breath, breathing in, know that you're breathing in. Breathing out, know that you're breathing out. Patience. Peace. What is your deepest aspiration? Letting go of thoughts, and coming back to just what is happening here and now. What is your deepest aspiration? Not trying to think about it. Just waiting with the question. What is your deepest aspiration? So if you do this yourself, you'd probably take a little longer to do it than we did. But I wanted to leave a few moments for a little exploration of what happened for you or any questions you might have. Anything?
Thank you for the wisdom you put out. I don't know if what I'm about to say shows I really got what you said or totally misinterpreted it. But I was just keying in on that part about striving for things that you think will bring you happiness. And I know most of my working life has been in marketing and sales, and there's always been quotas I've had to hit. And no matter what organization I've been with, after reaching their quota, there's about 5 minutes of congratulations and a plaque and maybe a bonus check. And then telling me, oh, we'll really love you if you now double what you did. And there's no end to that. And then I was thinking, you know, a lot of us, you know, we strive for what we think will be the perfect soulmate or spouse that will bring us bliss. Or, I mean, who wouldn't want to win the, you know, $50 million in a lottery if for no other reason than you can go into the office the next day and tell your boss and colleagues exactly what you think about them. But if you come to this realization that, you know, these things that you strive for are not really going to bring in happiness or something that's going to, the happiness is going to last more than 5 minutes or a day, then what is your life about? I mean, because we're all about striving for things. So if you strip away that and say, well, whatever I'm shooting for really isn't going to bring lasting happiness, then what's left?
That was the question the Buddha asked. Yeah. That was exactly the question the Buddha asked. Is there a happiness that lasts? And he found the answer in this turning the attention towards our experience and pulling away the veils of deception around what we think will make us happy. So it can become a little bit unstable or feel a little bit odd as we enter this path, because it's like, you know, all of our old tricks don't work anymore. You know, we realize that, you know, the things that used to make us happy, they just don't do it. But then slowly over time, we begin to see a deeper kind of happiness that comes from just the willingness to be. There's a deeper happiness that comes from a letting go of needing things in the world that we think will cause us happiness. It's kind of this interesting little Aikido move. You know, it's like letting go of what we think will bring us happiness, we become happy.
Then are we still striving for anything?
Do we just
find a bodhisattva tree somewhere and sit under it?
There is a form of striving that is directed in a... So it's directed towards the truth, as opposed to being directed towards the thing that just keep us on this wheel of more and more unhappiness and dissatisfaction. It is striving towards what's in line with the truth. And that's where the teachings come in, essentially. They guide us. They say, okay, this direction, try this direction and see what happens. And in my own experience, trying that direction, I've become happier and happier and happier. You know, it's just like there's just much less needing things to be any particular way. So I have found the truth of these teachings to lead me towards greater happiness. And it actually brings a sense of purpose, because I see, well, my purpose has now become to let other people know about this. You know, this has helped me. I hope it can help you. And to me, this is a much better purpose in life than going and sitting in the office and, you know, writing 3D graphics documentation for games programmers. You know, it's like that brought me a paycheck, but it didn't really satisfy me. So there's a deeper satisfaction that comes with having our actions and our choices in line with what's more meaningful to us. So that is the exploration that I was asking you to begin tonight. What is it that's deeply meaningful to you? And then to begin to look at how your choices relate to that aspiration. And there is effort and energy we put in that direction. That's the energy that I talked about a couple weeks ago. So yeah, that's a great question. And it's one that we all have to kind of navigate, and it is an uncomfortable transition as we walk this path. So we need to stop. So may you all understand your deepest aspiration.